I'm Jim Packard, sitting in for Larry Mueller on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Now we switch gears, and we're going to be talking about The Wizard of Waukesha with Rob Lawrence of Malibu, California, who is the author of The Early Years of the Les Paul Legacy, 1915 to 1963. The book is published by Hal Leonard, and it is a stunning book of pictures and text and interviews with Les Paul himself, with many of the guitarists who've used his instruments over the years, and it's brand new by Rob Lawrence, and it contains a foreword by Les Paul, and it's published by Hal Leonard. You'll find out about the career of this musical giant, milestone guitarist, and recording innovator, and marvel at the world of cutting-edge guitar design, because in here you will actually see how the guitar was transformed by the work of Les Paul. Rob Lawrence, thanks very much for participating with us today.
You're welcome.
I'm very pleased with the book, very excited to have it, and just been fascinated by it.
I'm glad.
I know that you, in your foreword to the book, Les writes that the two of you met as you were researching the history of American guitars, and I take it that you had an instantaneous liking for each other.
Pretty much, yeah. We just kind of hit it off, and we've been dear friends ever since.
Now, you were researching the history of American guitars. What were you pursuing at the time?
Well, basically, I had met John Dopiera, a Czechoslovakian inventor who developed the Dobro and National guitars back in the mid-20s, and his stories that he would tell us about how the amplifonic guitar came about and all the people was so colorful. Mr. Rickenbacker and George Beauchamp and all these different people, and I just thought, wow, amazing history here. And I thought, why not put together a book on guitars about the American guitars and just the stories all about it. I sort of bit off a pretty big chunk because it's a very, very varied story with all the different companies. Epiphone is another company that has a very interesting past and lots of different brothers involved, and like the Dopieras, and fascinating story, like a novel. And so I thought, why not do a book on guitars? And so went on a guitar safari across the country with my buddy Steve Rodriguez, and we met all these interesting people all across the country in Nashville and New York. And Bud Eastman, the founder of Guitar Player Magazine, suggested I visit Les Paul on my trip, which I did. And sort of things fell together in a very interesting way. And as I wrote my column for Guitar Player Magazine, Rare Bird, about different types of guitars and the history of the first electric with Mr. Rickenbacker and the first Dobro and the Sunburst Les Paul, I realized that to do it justice was to do something in depth with the people behind the stories and the music and just tie it all together. And so it eventually transformed into a series of books that we're doing.
We're having a little problem with your level on your
I'll
telephone.
Speak up.
Okay, that's great. That's much better. For people who do not know the name Les Paul, born in Waukesha, Wisconsin, he is the Wizard of Waukesha. He, as a young boy, took piano lessons. One of his piano teachers once wrote a note to his mother, "Your boy Les will never learn music, so save your money. Please don't send him for any more lessons." And that was quite a mistake, because little did she know that Les would play on at least 36 gold records, record at least 70 albums, win 5 Grammys, and invent an entirely new instrument, the true solid-body electric guitar, and at the age of 93 is still performing Monday nights in New York City at the Iridium.
Isn't that remarkable?
It sure is.
He had a great ear, and I think some of the best musicians in the world, Carlos Santana, Eric Clapton, they can read music somewhat, but and charts easily, but to really, you know, get into the soul of music, I think you have to really have a great ear and and just let it flow through you, and Les was wonderful at that.
Mm-hmm. His instrumental side began with a battered old harmonica given to him by a man digging a ditch out in front of his house as he played on his lunch hour. I know he told me that story, and you wrote it down, so I believe it's true.
Yes, it is.
And then he began his assault on the player piano that his mother bought him. But I understand that he quit playing when he saw McCoy Tyner and didn't figure that he was ever going to approach his ability on the piano.
I thought it was Art Tatum.
Art Tatum. Maybe it was. I'll bet it was Art Tatum, which would be more of the jazz that he would be familiar with.
Yeah, McCoy Tyner is a contemporary today, I think. But, yeah, the piano was number one instrument back in the day, and Les basically, along with a few other people, Alvino Ray and Nick Lucas, and of course the great Eddie Lang, who pioneered jazz guitar, they all sort of got the guitar thing going into high gear, and Les Paul really gave it a kick, you know,
mm-hmm.
with the electric guitar, which is his next adventure.
Pieplant Pete, or otherwise known as Claude Moy, was quite an influence on him. Talk about what Pieplant was doing with this young guy.
Well, originally, Les had some local heroes, and Pieplant Pete was playing the Bashful Joe, and Les would go see them and hang out with them, and Les got some guitar lessons from him. And I luckily found a songbook that Pieplant Pete and Bashful Joe had both signed, which is in the book.
Yeah, and you have a picture of it in the book, do you not?
Yes.
By the way, we're talking about the early years of the Les Paul legacy, 1915 to 1963, by Rob Lawrence, and you're quite a guitar player yourself, I understand.
Oh, thank you. Well, I started playing in 63, and that's about the time that the Les Paul guitar had sort of disappeared from the scene for a while, and so I had heard rumors about Les Paul guitars and heard about Les Paul, but I really didn't know much about him, and back then, the King guitar in the Gibson line was the ES-355, like the 335 that B.B. King played.
Mm-hmm.
And Fender, of course, was big in California, and I was going to San Diego after coming back from Hawaii. And we were very influenced by the Fender guitars back then.
Right.
So we learned surf music and had flat wound strings on our guitars. But then I was deeply involved with R&B music before the Beatles came out, right around that time. And I got into playing guitar 4 or 5 hours a day and playing in bands and just had a lot of fun, you know, and started playing a lot of clubs around San Diego, and I taught guitar at La Jolla Music down there and from 67 into 71. And on the side, besides playing in gigs and stuff, I was the stage manager for KPRI concerts in San Diego, so I started meeting a lot of interesting guitar players like John Cipollina from Quicksilver, and he became another mentor of mine. And I was photographing guitars as a hobby because I'd found them here and there. You know, they were like used guitars. They weren't called vintage, and they were all over the place. And they were cheap, and Fender guitars for $100, old Strats and Teles. And eventually we started seeing these Les Paul guitars, and I found a 58 that my friend had. He bought it for $250, a Sunburst model. And, you know, he sold it to another friend of ours, a blues guitar player, Paul Cowie, and musicologist, and had that guitar, and so, you know, we were enjoying vintage guitars when they were just used guitars to us.
Mm-hmm.
I just kept playing in bands, and eventually I came up to Los Angeles to do some studio work and get more involved in the real music business. And eventually, after my stint in New York area and living with Les Paul in the mid-70s, I moved back to Los Angeles and got more involved with the studio and behind the scenes and record production. But I always play guitar, so I have played on a few platinum records. One was the Babies and John Waite,
mm-hmm.
at first. It's
yeah.
called, and I helped arrange a song years ago called Turn the Beat Around with Dickie Sue Robinson when I played in her band in New York. And I've played on a few videos here and there over the years, one with J-Lo, in fact, her ballad Alive 2 years ago. So I love doing studio work, but I'm a field player because of my R&B background and my great influence by Aretha Franklin, I approach the guitar as a musical vocal instrument because it's connected to our soul and to the universe. It's a very powerful thing, and so I love all that kind of stuff, you know. And I think Hendrix thing.
Didn't Les Paul always recommend play the melody?
Yes.
Play the words as you will to a song.
Yeah, well, he follows that philosophy too, and I think a lot of the great guitar players do sort of sing through their instrument, you know. So it's a special gift, I think, that some of us have to share with the world. I've been asked to do the Hendrix birthday anniversaries every few years, so I've done a few of those over here at the B.B. King's Club and the Universal City Walk, and I worked on and off for 2 years with Mitch Mitchell in the Los Angeles area, so I've been steeped in the Hendrix thing, too, which is it's a very special music, and he was a special man.
You have a photograph of him playing one of Les's guitars.
Yeah, that's a photograph that Elliot Landy graciously let us use in the book.
He calls it the Black Beauty, does he not?
Yeah, it's a Gibson Les Paul Custom Black Beauty, and I believe that's the guitar that's at the EMP Museum in Seattle now. I was just up there and saw that guitar. And Les Paul guitars, you know, have that big, warm, rich tone, and every so often you'll see even Stratocaster players who are so used to the comfortable, easy-to-play guitar, that sounds so much biting, more like a steel guitar kind of sound, like a Telecaster. A lot of artists in their palette will take the Gibson, or specifically the Les Paul guitar with its humbucking pickups and maple top, and the construction has a warm tone, because Gibsons were founded on rich tone, and that was their philosophy all along.
Mm-hmm. And how would that differ from Fender, let's say?
Well, the Fender guitar was based on the steel guitar pickup from his Champion steel guitar in 1949, and they built the Esquire guitars in 1950, and they were solid body pine with a maple neck, no truss rod, and they were fashioned somewhat like a Dreadnought solid body guitar. And Paul Bigsby had a big influence, of course, on Leo Fender back then, and Merle Travis had been playing the Bigsby guitar around Los Angeles, and Charlie Hayes, their salesman, said, well, why don't we have a solid body guitar? And Leo Fender and George Fullerton got their heads together, and they developed what became the Telecaster, and this sort of alarmed a number of other guitar builders.
You know, we're going to have to pause. We're going to have to pause here and catch up with the latest news, and then we will pick up that story of building the Les Paul model of Gibson guitars. After we look at the latest news, I'm Jim Packard, Martinez White, our on-air producer. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Good afternoon. I'm Jim Packard, sitting in for Larry Mueller on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Great to have you with us today as we talk about the Wizard of Waukesha, Les Paul, with Rob Lawrence of Malibu, California. He's the author of The Early Years of the Les Paul Legacy, 1915 to 1963, published by Hal Leonard. And Rob, again, it's a pleasure to have you with us today.
Thank you. Thank you.
I know that your email starts off with Flame Top 59, so I suspect it has a reference to your guitar.
Yes, it does. They've become sort of an icon over the years because it not only is the tone machine I was telling you about, but it's become one of the most prestigious electric guitars in the world because of its construction and its value. The values have just skyrocketed over the years, better than homes, in fact.
What was a guitar like that originally priced at?
About $250.
Mm-hmm. And then if you went on eBay or one of the other search machines, what would you likely see prices for that vintage guitar going for?
Well, any of those Sunburst models from 58 to 60 with humbucking pickups,
uh-huh.
even with plain wood on it, you would see them gathering in $250,000 up to $350,000, and then the fancier the wood, the chatoyance, the flame factor, the guitars go up in values $400,000, $500,000, maybe even more, according to how clean and original they are. But the gold tops from the earlier years and the customs as well with the fancy binding, those are all quite valuable too, and they're anywhere from $30,000 on up to $150,000 or a little bit more sometimes for the humbucking gold tops. But back in the day when we were collecting them, they were, you know, a couple hundred dollars, $400. And then in the early 70s, they went up to $1,000 for the Sunburst model. And then $2,000 in the 74 area, I guess, around there, 75. And they just kept going up. I sold one that a friend of mine had that I found earlier, and I sold it to Paul Stanley back in the day for $5,000 from the group Kiss.
Yeah.
We all thought that was amazing, you know, $5,000 for a Les Paul guitar, wow. And that's what he offered for it. And so, but then the prices just kept going. But then again, you know, there's such a large demand for such a high-quality vintage instrument because of the not only just the fact that it's rare, but because the tonality, the woods they used back then were already vintage, so to speak. They were dried out, and the wood had sat around for a long time. Not that long, but, you know, compared to the 30s with the banjos and stuff that Gibson made. But the seasoning of the woods gave these guitars an incredible tone right from the beginning.
Well, you can just feel it right through the pictures that you have in the book, because there's some excellent photography of some beautiful guitars in there. Of course, no history of Les Paul is going to be replete without some mention of Mary Ford, who I believe that when Les met her, she was with Gene Autry and was a backup singer for him.
Yes, Colleen Somerset, or Colleen Summers, was here in Los Angeles in Pasadena, and Les was looking for a singer and thought he could further his career having a musical team, and so he was having a sort of a jam session in his garage, and he knew she was coming over, and he went out in the yard and started mowing the lawn, you know, just to make the house look good, and he was wearing his fatigues, and she walked up and said, "Is this where Les Paul lives?" And he said, "Yes." And, "Oh, they're playing in there." And he goes, "Yeah, go on in there, you know." So she went on in there expecting to see Les Paul in the garage, and meanwhile Les ran in the house and got on his nicer clothes and came in the garage and said hello, and they fell in love.
As I understand it, that garage had something blocking the door, a piano or some piece of his recording equipment, and she had to go through the window of the garage.
Yeah, all the guests, they had to sort of climb through the window. And Bob Bain told me this, too, and numerous people would come over there, W.C. Fields, and all these people would record there, and Dave Barber and Peggy Lee, and they'd all have to climb in the window to get in the studio.
If you'd like to join this conversation, if you have questions about Les Paul, comments about his fabulous career, you can give us a call in Madison at 263-1890 or toll-free at 800-642-1234. And as always, our email address is talk@wpr.org. It was Mary at the wheel when the two of them had their terrible traffic accident, correct?
Well, it wasn't quite in the traffic. Basically, when Les and his son Bobby and I drove across the country together in 1975, Les spent about 5 hours telling us the story, how it happened. And he, after they had been in Waukesha visiting and so forth, and they were heading back to California while they were in Oklahoma, it was kind of icy road, and Les was in the back seat laying down, resting, and Mary was driving, and the wheels started to skid off the icy road. And so as the car went over the edge, off a bridge, like, and into this ravine, Les put his arm around her to protect her from the back seat, his right arm. Meanwhile, the car crashed and rolled over and so forth, and Les's arm was crushed at his elbow.
Mm-hmm.
So they lay there in this mess for quite a while, actually, until they finally found them. And very icy, and there was water down there and so forth. And eventually they were found, and they took Mary away first, and then Les, I believe. And my friend Don, his mother, took care of them in the hospital over there in Oklahoma City. And they decided to reconstruct Les's arm instead of amputating it. And they flew him out to California to some specialists here to actually get his arm going, and he has 7 screws in the back of his upper arm that somehow join the whole thing together, and he still has a little pain from that late at night, you know, from time to time, but they set it sort of low towards his navel, or a little bit below his navel, and it's a little bit low for playing the guitar, he thinks, but when he sort of swings his arm along, and he'll swing it into your handshake and so forth. So they saved his arm because they knew he was a famous guitar player, and he went ahead and finished some of his recordings that he'd been working on in Los Angeles with acetates, you know, with his arm in a cast, and he actually had the guitar on a table and his arm in a cast, and he went ahead and did those famous sound-on-sound recordings at Capitol. Releases the new sound, and Les completed his recordings, and Zeke Manners came along, who was a DJ and had heard about what happened, and he went over to the hospital to meet him and so forth, and he would later bring over blank acetates for Les to record on, but Les went ahead and recovered slowly but surely with a big cast on, and he played his Epiphone guitar back then, and they made some great hit records, you know, with sound on sound, even with his arm in a cast, and then he got to work with Mary Ford, who he named Mary Lou at first, actually, when they played at the Club 400, his brother's club in Waukesha. And Mary Ford and him went ahead and did those incredible How High the Moon, Vaya con Dios, and all that sound-on-sound recording stuff with Les. And Wally's mixer played a big part in that sound that they did, Wally Jones.
Yeah, you've got a picture of him in there. I hadn't heard of Wally, him before. Yeah,
Wally Jones was our dear friend for many years, and he developed a mixer that could allow Les and Mary to record with zero noise and get a really full, amazing sound, and all the engineers from the other record companies were marveling at how Les could get such a remarkable recording with all those different tracks and have the sound up so close and so front. It was remarkable. And Wally really was the third person involved in that whole situation that made it a reality.
Let's take some calls, and we'll start off with Jim in Viroqua. Jim, what's on your mind there?
Good morning. I just wanted to comment, you know, I have a Les Paul and a Strat, and I always go back to my Les Paul, but also that PBS series they did on Les Paul, Searching for Sound.
Chasing Sound.
Chasing Sound, yes, Chasing, thank you. I watch that at least once every couple of weeks, and it is available on DVD if anybody is interested. But I do have a question. A friend of mine has parts off of a 60s SG, the bridge and the tailpiece, and I have a Les Paul Classic, and I've been thinking about changing that over. Will that help with tone compared to what I already have, or do you even know that?
Well, the wood is the voice of the instrument, just like a person's voice is the criteria before you even get to the microphone. And so the tone of that instrument is, you know, an acoustical sound, even though it is a solid body. And Les pioneered his 4x4 log guitar in the early 40s and took it to Gibson, and they didn't think it was feasible, and nothing happened. And when they finally decided to do their solid body guitar after Fender came out with theirs, then they decided that we should get Les Paul to get involved and so forth, and the rest is history. But as far as putting older guitar parts onto newer guitars, I think a lot of people will take the reissue 59 models and put the humbuckings on from the early days, the patent applied for models. And those really, that's one thing that you can enhance the sound of a newer guitar, even though the body doesn't quite sound as rich and vibrant as the vintage models, you know, the sound, the smooth sound, and that grittiness that you can get out of a PAF humbucking pickup will enhance the sound. And sometimes the light tailpiece, the stop tailpiece, you know, will help, you know, get that sound, and you can adjust, change the potentiometers, little things like that. They add a little bit more color to the sound to get it a little more vintage. But basically, the voice of the instrument is the wood, in my opinion.
Okay. Thank you very much.
All right, Jim. Thank you very much for your call. And if you have a question or a comment for Rob Lawrence, why, you can call us in Madison at 263-1890. Otherwise, it's toll-free at 800-642-1234. You and Les were in Milwaukee back, I believe, in June. For some occasions there, including a book signing of your book. And I know that there's been some talk of various museums for Les and his materials over the years. What do you see happening in the way of the museum in terms of the Discovery World Museum or the Waukesha County Historical Society?
Well, the Waukesha Museum with Sue Baker, they started putting that together, and they were getting funds to put it together, and they started taking some stuff over there. Our friend Chuck Burge ran some equipment out over there, too, for Les. And it was coming together, but they were a little low on funds and so forth. And then some various political things came down, and then Discovery World got something really cool happening out there on the lake in Milwaukee, and they put together a beautiful display, and very impressive, and so forth, and Sue Baker was with us when we went to do a tour of it during the events when Les Paul was in town there, and I think a lot of Les' stuff has been meant to spread out into different areas, such as Milwaukee and Waukesha, and the Cleveland Rock and Roll Hall of Fame. I saw some great stuff there. And the Smithsonian Institute. So Les wants to share his materials and so forth, which has been cluttering up his house for years and years. He has so much stuff; it's amazing.
Well, this is the
house. I think it's fitting to spread it out to different museums around the world, you know, to share his legacy.
This is the house that was it Listerine, in for which he appeared live on television.
Well, it wasn't live, but they were doing television shorts. Like 5-6 minute television episodes, and where they play a few songs. And so they bought this house in Mahwah, New Jersey, in the early 50s, and set it up for television. And they filmed all these great episodes of Les and Mary at home. And Les would be, you know, tinkering around with a guitar, and Mary would be in the kitchen and stuff. And
yeah,
they even had
it
set up so Les could record her in the kitchen too, if he wanted to. But, you know, they had some funny skits, and the case of the missing guitar, was it? There was the last page. Les kept the last page of this book so Mary wouldn't read the very last page and discover what happened too early. They had a refrigerator that Les would unplug and so forth, and she'd try and figure out why things were defrosting and so forth. So there's a lot of little skits that they did, you know, and they had the Les Paul TB guitar, too, that they marketed, which is a junior with a Wakefield-type blonde finish on it, tinted finish. And so that was their Les Paul TV model that went along with the television show.
Another caller from Madison this time. It's Mark. Hi, Mark.
Hi, thanks for taking my call.
Well, Mark?
I've been playing guitar for probably longer than I care to admit, probably about 40 years. Anyway, back in the early 70s, a bass player from Baraboo I was playing with said, hey, there's a guitar for sale up here. Would you like to look at it? I said, yeah, what is it? And they said it was a Les Paul. So a lady's son had the guitar, and he brought it down. It was a red double cutaway. It was actually a Les Paul Jr. So I paid the princely sum of $80 for it. And some years later, I was in Nashville. I went to Gruen Guitars, and I said, you know, I wanted to confirm the vintage, and they told me it was 1959. And if I had all the original parts, it was probably worth about $2,000, and I paid $80 for it. And I still have it, and it's a prized possession. And a friend of mine lives in Washington, D.C., and saw Les in New York, and I thought maybe I'd go and have him sign it someday.
That's always
well,
great.
If you go to the Iridium, he probably sign it for you after the show. But yeah, I've remember so many times finding Les Paul Juniors for 25, 30, 40 bucks, you know, back in the old days and stuff, and watching them go up in value and so forth. But that particular model, that year, 59, for the Double Cutaway Junior, they made thousands of those guitars compared to their limited production runs of the Gold Tops and the Sunbursts and so forth. So they make quite a few of those, but they still have that quality Gibson tonality and those great necks and the super P90 pickups on them. So even their less expensive models, which they would, you know, list in their stores for $100, still had that innate Gibson quality and wood and feel. Just the tone and just the vibe of the guitar is intact no matter what model Gibson Les Paul you got.
You're preaching to the choir. Thanks so much.
All right, Mark. Thanks very much. We appreciate hearing from you. As we talk with Rob Lawrence, the author of The Early Years of the Les Paul Legacy, 1915 to 1963, it's published by Hal Leonard. And you can go to Hal Leonard Books.com, I believe, is the website there for that.
HalLeonard.com.
HalLeonard.com. All right.
Yeah, and then do a search in the search engine for Les Paul Legacy. There's actually two volumes. We had to split the book in two because it got to be over 700 pages. And so we decided to do the second half as the modern era of the Les Paul model, which I pick up in 1968 when Les Paul guitars reemerged on the scene. And then I carry it on through to 2008 and all the new stuff that I chronicle, all the different artist models, the Jimmy Page and the Peter Frampton and all those different models, Gary Moore and Ace Frehley. And then I get into the road to the Sunburst recreation, which had the Jimmy Wallace models and the Leos and the Guitar Trader models and so forth. So I do a whole dissertation on all those different instruments and the specials that they were making and so forth. And then, of course, Les Paul's career after we met and all the shows that we've done over the years at the Gene Autry Museum and the House of Blues and lots of concerts that we've done because I've been teching his shows for many years and mm-hmm. having fun and tuning up his guitar and making sure my old twin amp sounds good for him to play through and Rusty, his son, back at the board, mixing the sound and getting the tone together, because Les has very acute ears, and Les is a perfectionist, and he likes to get the best possible sound with his low impedance guitar, which he really, you know, started developing early on. The low impedance is like the microphones that we use today. They have a great presence of tone and wide frequency response, and Les caught on to the low impedance thing early on, and he's pioneered it for the guitar. And when he went back to Gibson, he and Wally Kamen, his bass player, went back there to Chicago and the CMI, and they went ahead and made a deal to push this along and release the Les Paul personal and professional models, which became the recording models with the low impedance. And the world never quite caught on to it because it was so clean and everybody wanted the distorted, smooth sound of the high amplification and distorted, you know, high impedance pickups, so to speak. But meanwhile, Les stayed on with the beautiful, glorious tone of low impedance, which is like putting your ear next to the string. It's just the presence is just amazing. But I've found a high volume amplification with low impedance pickups on these guitars that you can get an amplifier to go into natural distortion and get an incredible wide frequency response with this low impedance sound. And I think it's going to be a wave of the future.
Well, people can go see Les Paul on Monday nights. He's the most determined man that I've ever heard of as far as getting to the gig because he takes it so seriously. He's there at the Iridium Jazz Club at 1650 Broadway at the corner of 51st. It's down the street and across the street from the David Letterman Theater. And there you'll right. find him with John Coliani and Lou Palo and Nicky Parrott on bass.
Yay!
It's she's wonderful. Saw them 3 years ago when I did a story, wrote a story for Madison Magazine about Les Paul, and it was just a real joy to be in the Iridium.
Well, it's important for him to play these gigs every Monday. It keeps him going, you know. It's like square dancing for my folks. It's a very good thing to keep active and keep moving and stuff. And even though usually Les gets the limousine ride, of course, to these gigs and stuff, one time he didn't have one, and he actually drove himself all the way from Mawa, which is about a 45-minute drive down Route 17, down to New York City, and he played the gig, you know, drove himself even.
Rob, thank you so much for spending time with us today. It's been a real pleasure.
Well, you're welcome.
And I hope that we can talk to you when Volume 2 comes out.
Indeed, that'll be in February, and it'll be a box set with
all right.
Leonard. And thanks to Brad Smith and all my friends at Hal Leonard making this possible. And it's been a lot of fun. I just did a 17-city tour of America and Canada. And
I got to leave it there. Rob, thank you so much. The book is The Early Years of the Les Paul Legacy, 1915 to 1963. Our thanks to Martinez White for on our production. Coming up tomorrow at 11, How to Live to be 100, and then the author Nancy Unger of Fighting Bob La Follette here on the Ideas Network.